commission candidates. And I hear this theme running through some of their thoughts about citizen engagement. And that is, citizens need to engage. This is new when I hear them say, people have to show up. So I guess the question I'm asking is, do you think that there has been a problem with people showing up?
There is a problem with people showing up, but I think it's because the system has not lended itself to people being able to show up. For instance, we have public testimony available on all bills at the Oregon legislature, but it was too hard for real people to show up. You can't take a day off of work and find childcare for your kid, and you may speak a language that you don't even have the opportunity to have interpretation for. You may not even know when it's available or when that bill is up. Like, people can't show up if they don't know what we're doing. So our accountability is to make information available in a language and in a way that everyone can access, and to ask for that input. It's not about people coming to us. It should be about us going to the people. And people showing up, I think, is quite frankly, or the criticism that people aren't showing up is on us because we've made it too hard. People care about their communities. But when you're struggling to survive, you're not going to go to a city council meeting that lasts for too many hours, by the way. So we need to create a system where it is expected that I show up in the farm worker camps and in the public schools and park rows and, you know, have town halls and share how to get that information to me personally, but also when we have important legislation before us, whether it's at the city, the county, or the state or federal level, people should have the ability to weigh in a meaningful, and so that is on us to do better.
Maxine Dexter is a candidate for the U.S. House in Oregon's 3rd District. Ms. Dexter, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
I'm Don Merrill. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
A little jazzy music to start us off. Good evening and welcome to our special live election night coverage here on KBOO and also on our network of Oregon community radio stations. We're talking about you, KSKQ Ashland, KSKQ Medford, KYAQ Silots, KWSO Warm Springs, and of course KBOO Portland. From the KBOO studios, I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Yvonne Rivero, and this is election night. Democracy in action, where every vote should count. We have a lineup of special coverage, including experts, leading candidates, and an army of wonderful volunteers and staff here at KBOO.
Americans, of course, were deciding what direction to take their country with Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, or Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. We're expecting our first batch of Portland area votes to come in at 8 p.m. from Multnomah County. That's new this year. Also at 8 p.m., we're expecting our first batch of votes to be coming in from the Oregon Secretary of State's office for the entire state and for all of the ballot initiatives as well that we're seeing across the state. This is going to be such a historic election, Yvonne. What are you thinking so far? What are you feeling about it?
I think it is amazing. I'm energized to think about the possibility that women can have their voices heard after 4 years of American women losing their rights over their own bodies and their own destinies. And I think that there's so much at stake in this election that it is very, very important that that we connect and that we stay put for tonight. There's a lot of expectations, you know, both in for the good and then the possibility of things not turning out as expecting, as we are seeing, you know, in our own downtown in Portland, you know, expectations that, that there could be some either resistance or, you know, threat of
Yeah, there's been a lot of threats this year,
yes.
And that's something that everyone, I think, is really concerned about. But so far, Election Day itself seems like it went pretty smoothly. We did hear about the ballot box fires that happened, two of them in Vancouver area and one in Portland. But fortunately, things seem to have gone pretty well so far. If you're looking at the national races so far, what we can tell you is that Rick Scott, the Florida senator, has won re-election. Ted Cruz is leading his Senate race with 56% of the vote. In Ohio right now, it's still neck and neck. Sherrod Brown is fighting against Bernie Moreno. And Casey is leading in Pennsylvania, but this is with only 16% of the vote coming in. Alyssa Slotkin appears to be up, but again, this is with only 9%. Of the vote coming in. And right now, as you look across the country, it looks like a lot of the states that you would normally expect to follow along party lines are doing that pretty much. We're seeing like Vermont and Connecticut pretty early calls for Kamala Harris. Florida has gone to Trump, which was expected. Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina also to Trump. Georgia is still a toss-up at this point, and North Carolina also still a toss-up right now.
For those of you who are new voters, perhaps, remember that there's a difference of 3 hours because between Eastern time and Pacific time, and therefore the ballot boxes have closed at 8 p.m. in the Eastern states, and therefore we are beginning to receive information about the number of ballots winning. The special, you know, I think that we need to be giving special attention to the battleground, the so-called battleground states.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
It's all about the battlegrounds this year. And you saw the candidates just going back and back and back to the same states again and again. And that's just the function of our electoral college system.
Yes, and which indeed, it's you know, it's been considered you know, racially biased because even with a popular vote, you know, there are states that hold, you know, over 20% or more votes, and therefore, you know, it would seem to contradict the will of the people. And so, you know, I think there's a lot to say, you know, when the last election, when in the last election there was a call, there's a congregation of states calling for the assumption of the popular vote. It's
And from the swing states in the Midwest and the Sun Belt to blue states on the coast, everyone is watching for signs of where this election is heading. So joining us live right now is Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols. He is the author of several books about politics and history, and he served as a history professor at Oregon State University for 10 years and is now an endowed chair in history at The Ohio State University, but still makes it back here, fortunately for us, into Oregon to contribute content for the Oregon Historical Society. So welcome, Chris.
Oh, hi. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on this important election night.
Yes. Glad to have you back helping us for yet another election night, as you've done in the past. Well, first off the top, what trends are you seeing on where this election is tipping first at the presidential level?
Well, let's see. I mean, the most obvious thing, I think, is that there really haven't been any major surprises. A lot of us are watching anxiously, whatever our political position, parsing all the numbers, and nothing too surprising is happening. But I'd point out a few things that historians have looked to for years that are interesting and maybe give us a sense of what's going on. One is there some ballot splitting happening? So North Carolina is an example of this, where it looks like the attorney general, who's a Democrat, Josh Stein, has beaten the Republican, who's scandal-ridden, Mark Robinson. And yet, Donald Trump is doing much better than Kamala Harris in North Carolina. So that suggests that there's been some real ballot splitting there. People didn't like Robinson who were voting for Trump. That doesn't happen a lot anymore in American politics, and it gives you a little bit of a sense of what's going on at the intersection of presidential politics and sort of state-level politics. Another thing I think that's really important to be looking at as well, since this may take a number of days, is to look at the Senate races as a kind of harbinger or a bellwether of what's likely to happen in some of these swing states where we may not know even until late tonight or tomorrow what the final call will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so far Trump is the expected winner in 10 states with 101 electoral votes. Harris has 8 states in her total, including Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Illinois for 71. Again, this is really early times, though. Let's talk a bit about that Ann Seltzer Iowa poll. That was really a surprise, right?
Really fascinating, and I think this is one of the important recent trends that we need to put our fingers on, and we'll probably be looking back and either having a sense that, oh, wow, this late-breaking information was right, or it was just an outlier. So Seltzer's poll in Iowa, she's very well-known and very well thought of in the Beltway. Her Seltzer and company gets like an A-plus rating for their polling. Said that independents in particular were breaking towards Harris late and actually had Harris beating Trump in Iowa, which is really, you know, outside of what we'd been thinking was likely. Should we see that happen in other Midwestern states, the sort of thing of breaking, you know, women over the age of 65 favored Harris 2-1 in the Iowa poll. This would suggest that we could wind up seeing kind of the blue wall states and perhaps some others slightly tip with these razor thin margins in that direction, or frankly also just keep us up on the edge of our seats for a number of days.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about the Midwest right now, and especially Pennsylvania. They're so important, and it's been a long, long time since a Democrat has won without Pennsylvania. We saw Kamala Harris last night giving her final speech in the battleground state in Pittsburgh, basically just saying, please, people, vote for me. Democracy's on the line, she was saying. Well, tell us about the history of not only Pennsylvania, but the whole blue wall's importance and what we should be looking for tonight.
Yeah, so it's fascinating. You know, really the main blue wall as we talk about it now is a cluster of three states. It's Pennsylvania with 19 electoral college votes, Michigan with 15, and Wisconsin with 10. The kind of broader blue wall is actually roughly 18, and those are the main states that Democrats won from the Midwest to the West Coast from 92 to 2012. But Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin are really the keys. If you play around with any of the electoral college maps in how Democrats can win now and get to the 270 electoral votes they need. And it really hasn't been until since the early Cold War that Pennsylvania didn't help support the eventual winning candidate. In fact, the state of Pennsylvania has voted for the overall victor in something like 48 of the 59 elections. And because Pennsylvania was an original state, it's been around longer, so it's got a longer set of that. And in fact, it's tied with, you guessed it, Michigan and Wisconsin for the longest active streak of voting with the winning candidate. So if you see Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin go one way, you'd have to assume that the election goes to that individual as well.
Yeah, I was just in Wisconsin last week, and I saw signs for both candidates in some of the real rural areas of Wisconsin. So I know it sounds like that's a harbinger of, anyway, it seems like it's going to be very tight. And usually those three states tend to vote together. So that's why they're called the blue wall.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Well, there's been a lot of talk, and Yvonne and I were just talking about this a moment ago, about possible violence or disarray after this election, and even while the counting's underway. Do you think this year is going to be quite different after what we saw in the wake of the 2020 presidential election?
Well, on the one hand, well, first, I mean, we should just obviously say that the fact that we're talking about violence, that people wanting to overturn the results of an election or intimidating poll workers and people in line to vote is repugnant and wrong and not healthy for a democracy. You know, one of the things I've been watching, frankly, right now, wearing my historian hat and doing politics and foreign policy, is that there are lots of reports of bomb threats that appear to have been phoned in from Russia. this year in Georgia counties, in Arizona, Nevada. I don't know how we'll sort that out. We'll analyze that later. But, you know, if you're thinking about the heightened tensions of our current moment and this argument that there's election interference, there's no doubt there's election interference coming from outside the country. And that's part of what's exacerbating, fanning the flames of violence. You know, so that's a major worry for me. I think this may be different because, as you saw, say, in the city of Philadelphia, elected officials and law enforcement are ready for it. You're also seeing this in other states like Michigan and in downtown Detroit, where they're counting all the absentee ballots right now. Michigan changed its laws in 2022 so that they could be counted earlier in the week, so you wouldn't wind up with protests outside. And they've got law enforcement there ready in case there are protests if the counting were to go long. So you have a combination of preparation and some new laws that I think will mitigate against immediate violence. But, you know, my worry here is if this election and this count continues to go on for many days, that we may see some of that disarray, at least, and chaos that could just make things worse.
We're talking to Dr. Chris Nichols tonight on election night. Now, we're also closely watching the House races for Congress, and two of the most competitive ones in the country happen to be right here in the Pacific Northwest, where in Oregon District 5, incumbent first-term Republican Lori Chavez Dreamer is facing off against Democratic State Representative Janelle Bynum, who has defeated her at the statewide level before. What can you tell us about why that race is so important nationally?
Well, this has been one of the most, as you know well, the races that's been looked to by both parties as an essential race to win. So, you know, Chavez DeRuymer is first-term congresswoman, first Republican to represent the district in a long time. You know, I think you and I were talking about this just a few years ago, what a remarkable victory that was, and the way that districting played out in the state. You know, this is one of the most potentially toss-up kinds of races around. Cook Political Report, all the other ones have said that. And so you've seen tons of money come in. You've seen the Speaker of the House and the Minority House Leader come into the state. I mean, you've had all kinds of national political attention on that race. And, you know, Bynum's actually defeated Chavez DeRuymer before, and that's an interesting dimension of this as well, that they've got a history, that they've both been in the state, they both have name, you know, some name recognition. So we'll see what happens there. But like several of the major House races in the state of Washington and the state of Oregon, these may be what tip the balance in the House of Representatives this year.
Yeah, and there's another one, an extremely closely fought race in the Vancouver area in Washington District 3, right across the river from us. Democrat Marie Gluckenkamp-Perez is trying to fight off repeat Republican challenger Joe Kent. Major money being pumped into that race, too. Will it make a difference, though, to have a financial advantage as the Democrats do in both of these races?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are some distinctions here, right? This is a seat that was a surprise victory by Gluckenkamp-Perez. And she's running again against Republican Joe Kent, who's been endorsed by Donald Trump, but also has said quite a few inflammatory things that are clearly working against him on women's reproductive rights, on impeaching Joe Biden, and a host of other kinds of issues. So the money may matter a lot here, because I believe the last margin was something like less than 3,000 votes of all those cast for Gluckenkamp-Perez's victory. So you have to assume that this is yet another one that's going to be razor close. And the previous, you have to remember the case here, the previous person holding the seat was a moderate Republican, Herrera Butler, but mm-hmm. she voted to impeach Donald Trump, and so she was primaried by Joe Kent. So you have Kent coming from the farther right in positioning here, and that may work to his disadvantage yet again.
And Andrew Salinas is facing a repeat challenger, Mike Erickson, in Oregon 6, but what I'm seeing is that she's more likely to win re-election. You used to live in her district, so what can you tell us about that?
I did. Well, people were very excited about her running, her candidacy. Last time I was in Oregon just a few months ago, talking to friends, a number of people said that she was great in reaching out for small donations and speaking to her. So there's a sense, at least in my networks, that she had a real chance and that people liked her as a first-term Democrat incumbent running the 6th. You know, she won. She beat Erickson, so it's interesting. We're looking at two right now, two two races that are the same people against each other yet again. And she won by 2.5 points last time. Generally, incumbents do better in the next round, assuming that they don't have any scandals or major gaffes. And she has a huge fundraising edge. I mean, I think it's 10 times as much. And that's going to really help her in this race. You know, I think that she's quite likely to pull it out, but you just don't know right now in the political environment.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Dr. Nichols. We really appreciate you being on with us.
It's great to be on with you. It's amazing to think of what all the many races in the Pacific Northwest are going to mean for the country as a whole.
Yes, yes. We're definitely watching all of them very carefully, and we're very grateful for your support tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to go now to a national update. And according to the Associated Press and the New York Times, polls are closed in 41 of the 50 states as of 6 o'clock. The presidential race has been called in 18 states, and Trump is expected winner in 10 states with 101 electoral votes, including Indiana, Florida, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Harris has 8 states in her total, including Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Illinois for 71 electoral votes.
Let's talk for a moment about some of the things that are on the ballot in Oregon. There are several measures that voters are considering. Measure 115 would establish an impeachment process, create an impeachment process of statewide elected officials with a two-thirds vote from each chamber of the legislature. The offices that this would cover, be covered by this measure, include governor, secretary of state, treasurer, and attorney general. Measure 116 would remove lawmakers' power to set their own pay. It would create an independent commission that sets pay for statewide elected officials, including state lawmakers, the governor, and state judges. And this means lawmakers would not be able to have the power to set their own pay. And some say it would bring more fairness and accountability to government. Measure 117 would allow voters to rank candidates. It would give voters the option to use ranked choice voting for statewide and federal offices, in which voters can rank backup candidates or just choose one like they do now. Oregon would join 50-plus places across the U.S. that already successfully use ranked choice voting. Then there's Measure 118, and this one seems to have the most opposition from what I've seen, which is it would require rebates to residents from a corporate tax, increase the state corporate minimum tax to 3% on business sales of more than $25 million in Oregon. Some experts warn that this rebate program would divert billions of dollars from services and shortchange Oregon schools. And then finally, Measure 119 is cannabis workers' rights would provide Oregon cannabis workers the same ability to join a union that most other American workers currently have, allowing them to collectively bargain for workplace conditions, safety, and product standards. So just a few things that are on the statewide ballot right now.
Right. And it's 6:21 tonight in Portland, Oregon, and you still have time to go and drop those ballots.
That's right.
In your many, many ballot boxes around your library or elections office, so don't leave it anymore and don't think about it because there's traffic.
And it's so, not too late. In fact, you still have a whole hour and a half and then some to get there if you haven't.
And if you are voting in person, remember that if you are there at the offices and you're in line, even if it's 8 p.m., you can still cast your vote.
Yeah.
So do it. You know, this is a very, very important night, mm-hmm. and every vote counts.
That's right. And I know in Multnomah County and in both Portland and Gresham, the offices are going to be open till 8 o'clock to take anybody's questions. So if people are still concerned and they have a question, they'll still be open for that as well. So everybody should get out and vote. And there's so many other important things on the ballot. And we didn't even mention this yet that, you know, there's going to be a new governor in the state of Washington. That's a huge race as well that we'll watch. Governor Jay Inslee is stepping down after 12 years as governor. And that means that either the state's attorney general, Democrat Bob Ferguson, or the Republican former congressman and King County Sheriff Dave Reichert, they're the two who are running to replace Inslee. And another longtime lawmaker stepping down is Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer. After serving 28 years Democrat Dr. Maxine Dexter is facing Republican lawyer Joanna Harbor for U.S. House District 3 in that one, which covers most of Multnomah County and some of Clackamas and Hood River counties. And that's going to be something else we're going to be watching closely tonight. There's also close congressional races across the country in New York and Los Angeles that could all play into this whole balance of power that people are watching very closely tonight in the House to see if it remains under Republican control or Democratic control.
Thank you. And we are going to be switching now to one-of-a-kind interview that we have with Reyna Lopez, chair of the Pineros and Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, the Tree Planters Union, PECUN. Ms. Lopez is on the line. Welcome, Reyna.
Hey there. It's great to be here with you.
It's fantastic to have you with us tonight in this incredibly important night tonight, especially for women and Latinos, of course. And Reyna Lopez is the chair of the PECUN union based in Woodburn, Oregon. And Reyna, we wanted to talk to you about your priorities for Oregon and the kind of work that you have been doing in the state.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, and thank you for having me here today. And hopefully, I don't know if I hear a little echo, but hopefully there's no feedback on your side.
No, we hear you fine. Your voice is clear. Yes.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for having me here today. Yeah, I mean,
it's a pleasure.
As you can imagine, it's been a big night, even just so far. Not all the election results are in, but, you know, for the Oregon Latino community, we've definitely been bracing ourselves for this moment and in many ways planning scenarios on what the national could be. But also there's really important things that are happening here at home. Right. And for PECUN, we are a union of farm workers, and that's where our history really comes from. But over time, we have become so much more. In fact, we expanded our mission to also include Latinx working families, and our agenda has really been prioritizing different issues that really reflect that. And this year, we have a lot of things on our mind that have come directly from our members. Our members want us to fight for immigration reform and continue to fight for that, despite the fact that we haven't seen legalization. This still continues to be one of the top issues for workers, immigrant workers and immigrant families, Latino workers and Latino families across the state. And we are continuing to talk about those issues. We also are very dedicated and interested in trying to gain collective bargaining rights for farm workers and figuring out how we can bring that to Oregon in the very near future. But also there are many other issues that we're going to be seeing in the Oregon legislature that are going to be critical when it comes to who's going to be representing us in the House of Representatives this year, in the State House of Representatives. And we have a immigrant rights package that we have been pushing and asking these candidates if they would support that. And the immigrant rights package includes the home fund to ensure that, that immigrant workers are able to make rent. This is really a big issue right now, housing, not just for Oregon at large, but also for Latino communities and Latino families. Continue to have funds for universal representation so that we can guarantee representation for our immigrant communities if they are caught up in deportation proceedings or any other issues that come up of that nature. Justice for indigenous language speaking communities. Many people don't know, but farm workers, some of the top languages that they speak are not just Spanish, they're indigenous languages of Mexico and Central America. And right now there is no guarantee for folks to have access to indigenous language interpreters when they have, a court appointment or what have you. So trying to make sure that there is a guarantee for that. And also the Food for All campaign. It's a huge campaign that PECUN is supporting, trying to ensure that every Oregonian has access to food, and including our kids, our elders, no matter what their immigration status is. into SNAP benefits to make sure that our communities aren't going hungry. But we're also doing a lot of defense as well. Many of you have heard that there was a big victory for farm workers over the last couple of years. We passed farm worker overtime to ensure that farm workers had a guaranteed overtime pay over 40 hours a week. But, you know, we're defending it against folks that don't want it to get to 40 hours a week. So that is always something that we're on the lookout for, and also just ensuring that our labor rights as Oregonians are being enforced. And as you all know, we've had some really great wins for Oregonians over the past few years, you know, like paid family leave and paid sick days. But a lot of what we hear is that sometimes when employers don't follow the law and people want to bring a complaint, it's really difficult to navigate those things. So those are some of the priorities we have. And this is why it's so important that we have good representatives in our elected officials that are supporting these agendas.
Exactly. I wanted to talk to you about your perspectives as a union leader, but also as a woman, on the importance of the women's vote in this election.
Oh, wow. It's going to be critical. The women's vote is going to be critical. And we know that it's going to have a significant impact. We are a voting bloc that is a force to be reckoned with. And not only within women as a whole, but within ourselves, the diversity of women, the impact of educated women is going to be really strong in this election. Latina women, who we know have been really leading the charge within our own families to push for progressive policies and to activate our communities to be able to organize and to vote. Black women, obviously, who have been saving the United States for centuries. And we know that this is going to be huge, especially when it comes to the issue of our bodies and making sure that we have a right to an abortion. And that cannot be ignored. It cannot be ignored the moment that we're in. It cannot be ignored the political state of things. And it cannot be ignored that no matter what happens in this election, we are entering a phase of something new, and we got to step up and take leadership. And that's what I've seen from women this election. And I'm sure that that will be reflected once we start to see the results of everything come in.
Right. As the 8 p.m. hour approaches, where are you watching the election at?
Well, as some of you may or may not know, Pecun, we are headquartered in the Mid-Willamette Valley in a town called Woodburn, Oregon. It is where our community is based, and we have been working really hard, actually, to get Leslie Munoz in House District 22 elected. This is a really important district. House District 22 is the first BIPOC majority House district in the entire state. It means that most of the voters and the community that lives in that district are people of color, and Woodburn itself is a majority Latino municipality. So when you go there, you see it reflected in the little stores and the shops and the businesses, but it has a really deep history in the farm worker movement. And we have been knocking doors. We endorsed her very early on and have been doing a full bilingual, bicultural campaigning for her. Many people don't know that traditional campaigns don't actually do a fully bilingual, bicultural, very specific outreach to Spanish-speaking communities, but that has been the center and the heart of the campaign there. And really, House District 22, because of the Latino community there, because it's a very vibrant agricultural district, one of the most vibrant agricultural districts in the state, that outreach to Latino voters in that area is critical to be able to get House District 22 to be represented by someone who's reflective of the faces of our community.
Wasn't Teresa Alonso León your representative in the last session?
Here's how we actually lost this district to a Republican, which was a really difficult situation for Pecun. But Teresa Alonso León was a historic win in House District 22. She was the first migrant indigenous Latina to represent that district. She ran for the first time in 2016. And then in 2022, she actually decided to run for the new congressional district that Oregon gained, which is Congressional District 6, now actually represented by another Latina, Andrea Salinas. But we ended up losing that seat when Teresa didn't run again to Tracy Kramer, which is the person that we're actually trying to take it back from, because we do believe that this district needs to be represented by a Latina, needs to be represented by someone who has deeper roots in the farm worker movement, who has a deeper connection to immigrant communities. And we have felt that loss significantly because we just simply don't have that same attention, you know, from the current representation. So we're hoping to get the district back, and it's going to be a really important district for Latino communities across the state, because, you know, one thing we've heard about a lot of our Latino representatives who are in Salem today is that there's Latinos that call them from across the state, and it doesn't matter where they are. They feel like they represent a lot of people that are in every corner, even though their district is, you know, whether it's specifically in the Willamette Valley or Gresham or Hillsborough or whatever, wherever it is.
I wanted to mention how the representative in power right now, the challenger, was running English language ads for the beginning of her campaign up until about 2 or 3 weeks ago, when somebody realized that they needed to run the Spanish language, you know, the Spanish language campaign in Spanish. So, you know, that goes to say how involved they are with the communities, especially in a district when over 50% of all the district is BIPOC and Spanish speaking. So,
absolutely. You know, and I think that that's also a good thing. It's good to see that Republicans are waking up to that too, that they need to be reaching out to Latino communities. And I think it also creates a good pressure too on the Democrats too, to be able to deepen their involvement in our communities and not just, you know, look for the vote when it's time to get elections and votes in.
Yes, we have one more minute for this interview. I really appreciate you being able to be here with us tonight. You know, it's really, really important that we are as close in talking with as many people as possible as we approach the night, you know, and we move into the next phase, you know, once we know the results. And I just wanted to ask you, what are your national alliances, allegiances, and plans in case things turn out to be not what we are hopefully expecting for the night?
Well, we are very connected to a national movement. We're affiliates of the Center for Popular Democracy. We're affiliated with the National Working Families Party. I'm actually the co-chair of the Oregon State Working Families Party and also the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. And there's a lot of contingency plans, but I think it kind of spans between what are we going to do to ensure our immigrant communities are protected, and also if there is political violence against our communities, how are we going to make sure that we are organizing and do what we do best, which is ensure that we're taking care of each other and we're protecting our communities.
Exactly. This is the message. And of course, we will like to have you, if your time permits, during the regular Spanish language casting, at least in Cebu, every Tuesday and Sunday. Thank you so much for being here with us. And I'll pass it on to Annette. Thank you, Reyna.
Thanks, Reyna. And thanks, Yvonne. Let's take a quick look at some of the really intriguing races at the statewide level and what the polling indications have been for some of them. The polling about Oregon voters picking a new Secretary of State, Attorney General, and Treasurer this fall. Democrats have controlled these statewide offices for many years. Oregon voters have only elected a Republican to serve as Secretary of State one time since 1985, and a Republican hasn't served as a state treasurer or attorney general since 1993. But the polling shows that the contest to replace Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum is expected to be the most competitive of these statewide races on the ballot. It's pitting former Democratic Oregon House Speaker Dan Rayfield against Will Lathrop, a former deputy district attorney in Marion and Yamhill counties. Both of these candidates have raised around $1 million for their campaigns. Rayfield slightly ahead in fundraising. Then in the Secretary of State's race, we have Democratic State Treasurer Tobias Reed. He's facing State Senator Dennis Linthicum of Beatty, who's barred from seeking re-election in the Senate seat after he participated in a 2023 walkout. Of course, the next Secretary of State is a very important job. It's second to the governor, and actually they would step in case something happened where the governor was no longer able to fulfill their duties into the governor's seat. The governor is going to be tasked, the Secretary of State is going to be tasked with trying to restore some trust there after some significant upheaval with Shamia Fagan, Oregon's last elected Secretary of State, who resigned in May after it came to light that she had taken a consulting gig to the tune of $10,000 a month with a marijuana company. In the treasurer's race, we have Democratic State Senator Elizabeth Steiner taking on State Republican Senator Brian Boquist, who is barred from seeking re-election in the Senate after also participating in that 2023 lockout. So a lot of important races at the state level going on. Now, I understand we are going to be coming back in a couple of minutes. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the mayor's race in Portland, the Multnomah County Commission races, ranked choice voting on the ballot for the first time in the Portland area. But let's take a bit of a break, and you're listening to special election night coverage on KBOO Community Radio and on Oregon community media stations all around the state. I'm Annette Newell, and here with Yvonne
Rivero.
Latina, mire, que le gustan los bailadores, el que cura sin medicina.
Este es el combo, señores, que toca y toca profundo. Este es el combo, señores, que Puerto Rico ama al mundo.
Este es el combo, señores, si el que tiene su melao, que está en sus años mejores y sigue con su tumbao.
Welcome back to a special election night coverage on KBOO Community Radio and on our Oregon community media stations all around the state. I'm Annette Newell.
And Yvonne Rivero here on the special tonight, the special elections.
Yes,
tonight.
And this election is so different for people in the Portland area. This, of course, is after the Charter Commission, a group of 20 community leaders appointed in December of 2020, spent a whole year and a half researching and engaging with the community about alternative government structures. Then in November of 2022, Portlanders overwhelmingly supported ballot measure 26-228 to change their government and the way we vote. Well, we saw that on our ballots in this election. This is the first year of both the new structure and of ranked choice voting. So what's changing? A whole lot. The city is expanding the number of city council seats from 4 to 12. And instead of representing Portland as a singular municipal block, the city was broken up into 4 distinct districts. 3 city council members will represent each district. City council members will no longer be in charge of bureaus. Instead, they'll focus on setting policy and engaging with the community. And the charter added yet another role, the city administrator, who will oversee the bureaus and then work closely with city officials. The mayor and half of the city council will run for 4-year terms, while the other half of the city council and the city auditor will run for 2-year terms. Portland also gets to participate in ranked choice voting this year, a system where voters rank their candidates instead of selecting only one candidate. This year, Portland is using ranked choice voting for the mayoral, city council, and city auditor races. Now, in 2026, Multnomah County is going to join in this party and use ranked choice voting to vote on county positions. For single candidate races like the mayoral and city auditor races, the threshold to win is 50% of the total votes plus one. Votes are counted, they're tabulated in a series of rounds. If a candidate reaches that threshold in the first round, after all the ballots are counted, they win. If no candidate reaches the threshold, the votes go through round two. And in the second round of counting, the bottom candidate is eliminated. The one with the least votes is eliminated. Their votes go to the candidate who the voter ranked next. Now, if no one reaches the threshold after that round, the votes go to yet another round, a third round of counting. The candidate with the least amount of votes in round two is eliminated, and their votes go to whoever the voter ranked next. Now, this keeps going on for as many rounds as it takes until a candidate reaches that threshold. The city council race is a multi-candidate race, which gets tabulated a bit differently. Each district will have three winners, not just one. The threshold to win is 25% of the votes plus one. Votes are still tabulated in rounds, and if no one reaches the threshold, the bottom person's eliminated. Their votes are redistributed to who the voter ranked next, like in the single candidate race. But a candidate could get above the threshold, and if they have more votes than they need to win, those votes get redistributed to whoever that voter ranked next. However, this gets a little tricky here. Redistributing just the surplus votes wouldn't be fair to everyone who voted for the winning candidate, so those voters did not necessarily rank the same candidate for second place. So all of those votes get broken up into proportions. Part of the vote goes to rank one candidate, the other part of the vote goes to rank two candidate. Complicated math here, but a simplified version is divide the surplus number of votes a person gets by the total votes they received, and that percentage is how much goes to the voter's next choice.
And then you find like 20 different candidates for the same 30, position.
There were 30 in mine.
30.
My district. Wow.
What district are you in?
Three.
In
district
yes.
Three, Southeast Portland.
Yes, we're on two. And, you know, doing the research, you know, trying to get to know who's going to represent us. You know, it sounds good. You know, it's an experiment, you know, and I am really hoping that we can be more participant of our civic life. And we're going to talk a little now about what is ranked choice voting. Portland also gets to participate in ranked choice voting this year, 2024, a system where voters rank candidates instead of selecting only one candidate. This year, Portland is using the ranked choice voting for the mayoral, city council, and city auditor races. In 2026, Multnomah County will use ranked choice voting to vote on county positions. For single candidate races like the mayoral and the city auditor races, the threshold to win is 50%. As it was mentioned, votes plus one. The votes are counted or tabulated in series of rounds, as we already talked about. As we said, let's talk about a few quick facts. And this is the first year that it's happening. It was voted on in 2022. Again, the mayoral, city auditor, and city council races, and the length of the service, the mayor will serve for 4 years. City auditor will be only in 2 year terms. Then, in 2026, Multnomah County will adopt the ranked choice voting system. Again, the single winner race is 50%. Plus one, and all votes are tabulated in rounds as we have talked. If a candidate reaches the threshold in the first round of counting, they win, goes to second or third, and then they continue until the candidate with the least amount of votes gets eliminated, and their votes redistributed until a candidate reaches threshold. In a multi-race, a multi-winner race, that's the city council, 25% of all votes plus one. And why 25? Mm-hmm. It's because if three people get slightly more than 25%, there's no room for a fourth candidate. Similar to a single winner, votes counted in rounds. But if a candidate could run away with a lot of votes over the threshold with surplus, if surplus, votes from winning candidate get redistributed. But there's no whole votes. that would be fair. Voters who choose winning candidates might not have all chosen the same candidate for round two. Instead, the surplus votes get divided by total votes. That percentage is how much goes to voters' second choice.
So we're going to be watching the results from the Multnomah County Elections Office, and they have already warned us that the initial results that they're releasing at 8 o'clock tonight, don't take those to the bank. They're saying it's probably going to take a couple of rounds of voting before we actually have a winner. We may be able to sit, we'll probably be able to tell you who's leading at the point at 8 o'clock, and then they're going to be following up with some more results at 10 o'clock. So we'll have those two big dumps of votes that we'll at least have some idea of how Portland voted. But again, you know, they're still going to be counting ballots that were just dropped in today and won't even get there till tomorrow. So there's going to be definitely a lag in time before we get the results in this. I also saw this is kind of an interesting thing too. Florida had something called an Amendment 3 in this election. It turns out that even though it did receive 57% of the vote, it will not pass. It actually would have protected the constitutional right to an abortion before fetal viability, and they actually needed 60% to meet the threshold in that state. So that was something that people were watching closely to see if abortion, usually if abortion rights were on the ballot, typically that was a victory for on the side of those who were pro-choice. In this case, it sounds like it was not. And the amendment in Florida that would a ballot measure that would have legalized recreational marijuana for adults 21 years and older and possession up to 3 ounces of marijuana. Again, it needed a 60% threshold to pass. It got 57%. So both of those measures, both abortion and the marijuana amendment have failed in Florida tonight. So that's another result that came out of that. Out of this election this evening. And then we have a mayor's race going on, and I'm sure it has caught a lot of attention for you, Vaughn. What are some of your perceptions of what's been going on in this mayor's race that we have such a diversity of candidates?
It's a diversity of candidates, which responds to, diversity of voices. Mm-hmm. In calling for the kind of city where we want to live in. You know, we, as you know, we had been under a set of siege sometimes in terms of the way that we want to define ourselves as Portlanders, right? And the political support that we want to have and the activism in the city, where, you know, it has been in opposition to the ideas that are coming sometimes from Washington, D.C. And so I think that it is really, really interesting to see the number of candidates that we have with their different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I was surprised, you know, in every election, I am always, you know, my heart gets, warm when I realize that anybody can run for mayor, you know, and then you have this idea that Bud Clark came from, you know, from just being a citizen of Portland, you know, and having some of the most memorable offices, you know, still loved by so many, many Portlanders. You know? Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I think it's really, you know, government is sometimes complex. Government is something that has to be done with experience and love, right, for what you do. And there's the quality of being a state man or state woman, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, experience, I think it's something very, very important, you know, and we'll see. You know, we cannot talk of personal choices, of course, but I see that it's been a really, really, really close
You have like a Carmen and Mingus, who are already on the city council, running, and Renee Gonzalez, too, also the three of them who are already in the council. And then you have outsiders like Keith Wilson and Viva Las Vegas running. And
we've had
such a lively and really important discussion, and all the debates that they've been having, I think, have been really interesting and enlightening. And also some of the candidates that are running for these city council seats, for example, East Portland, east of 205 is District 1. Candace Avalos, she is the executive director of climate justice for a nonprofit called Verde, and very interesting work with law enforcement accountability. She's Housing First, but not Housing Only, and for Safe Streets for Portland. Steph Routh, another interesting candidate, former executive director of Oregon Walks, was adjunct faculty at PSU Urban Planning School, and her issues include community safety, investing in first response to Portland street response. A lot of these candidates were talking about Portland street response, I noticed, in this go-round, and they're looking at that as a very successful program that they say should be more fully funded.
Especially looking at our demographics, you know, especially looking at the fact that Oregon is probably the one state in the whole nation that has the top number of unhoused residents, let's say,
right.
And then the mental health crisis and addictions that we are looking at. You know, I have to mention that the state of Oregon has launched, a sizable budget of, I believe, $6.3 million to develop, new programs around the state for treating addiction, you know, and having housing components, and having language access and cultural access, you know, which has been, you know, something that has been lacking, and therefore creating, inroads for people to stay there in difficult spots, right?
Yeah,
for a long time. I think there's a lot of conversation too about the kind of city, you know, the revival that we want for Portland, not just coming from the business community, but also from community advocates, you know, talking. So I'm really, really inspired by looking at people who have experience. You know, you were mentioning Candace Avalos, who has been working so hard, you know, with our community as well, who's a woman too, and Afro-Latina as well, you know, which to me, again, is really inspiring to see the commitment, you know, and, you know, even in a city like Portland, in a state like Oregon, the wealth of civic involvement that our Latino community is bringing to this elections, you know, especially, after what we heard, you know, the insults that we heard against, you know, in the national arena against our Puerto Rican citizens. These are U.S. citizens.
They are.
That
yes,
were offended, you know, which to me, I was surprised in seeing that Puerto Rico is actually, you know, the elections there are pointing towards a third candidate from third party. And so it's pretty interesting, I think, to see the developments that we're seeing. You know, I am thinking that we will be getting more information, you know, and more stable information as the night goes on. You know, it's 6:56 here in Portland, Oregon. And so there's a lot of information and then misinformation. So we are cautiously moving forward with numbers and, and then these tendencies as well.
Yeah. And speaking of Puerto Ricans, there's an estimated population of 500,000 in Pennsylvania alone. And that's one of the swing states. So that they're predicted to have an extreme impacts on the election in some of these swing states.
Exactly. And this is, I have to praise the idea that, as Reyna Lopez was mentioning, on the importance of carrying on campaigns both in English and Spanish, you know. And then in Pennsylvania, you know, I attended a conference with one of the mayor unions, SEIU 503, where, you know, it was being interpreted in 17 languages, you know, which wow. It's amazing, you know, the diversity that we have in the East Coast. We're getting close to the end of our portion.
That's right. And we're going to be taking a quick break here and then coming back. We're going to be swapping out to Ron and Reed. They're going to be taking over the show in just a moment. And then I'll be coming back in the 8 o'clock hour to kind of go through what's going on with Lisa Loving in terms of when we get that first batch of votes from the Oregon Secretary of State's office at 8 o'clock and also Multnomah County.
Right. But before we leave, we have 3 more minutes, but I wanted to say a piece of information that I was missing, and it is that Candace Avalos was actually backed by all the 4 mayor local newspapers in Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
So we'll be looking at the results tonight.
It's interesting to see those endorsements. That's quite remarkable, quite an achievement for a candidate to get that, because I noticed that across the spectrum of endorsements, there was a lot of variety of who they were picking as their favorites. Between right. environmental justice groups like certain people, the business groups like certain people, and you know, I guess that there's so many important issues on the table and so many great candidates. You know, that's the thing that I found when I was going through those 30 candidates in my district, just trying to pick 6 of them out of that group. They're fantastic people, and they seem like they're really active in the community. They really care and they love Portland.
Right. I think the important thing is that the new system will allow 3 of those. Yes. At least, you know, which makes it a more just, more equitable system. And I think it's important, too, because then we will have access mm-hmm. to be talking about policy, you know, from the citizens, right? The citizens. Yeah. I mean, the people living in the districts, right?
Yeah. And a lot of, they were also pointing out to the fact that the eastern part of Portland hasn't really had representation on the city council for many years. Most of the people who were on the council came from the west side. And so that's going to be a very different voice yeah. and a needed voice as
yes.
well.
We're going off the air, but really important remarks, you know, 205 all the way to Gresham. There right. were no voices, but that is, right. you know, that zip code is like a city in itself.
It is.
And the one with the lowest income in the state. We are leaving here tonight. It has been a pleasure being with you here on this
great.
Very
being
unique
with you,
night.
Thank
election
you.
Night 2024. We'll be looking into the magic hour of 20 hours tonight. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Ron.
We'll be right back.